Hello and welcome to Right Wing Dharma Squad's 35, continuing our discussion of Nagarjuna's Root Verses of the Middle Way. I am your host, Dharmakirti, joined, as always, by the squad of Aura and Nyamnaya Mindset, if y'all want to say hi.
Hello.
Hi, everyone.
Unfortunately, Storm can't be here with us today, but we look forward to his contributions, hopefully in, soon. But as for the topic today, we are, as I mentioned before, continuing our reading of certainly one of the most foundational, arguably the most foundational text of Mahayana Buddhist philosophy. Last week we discussed a little bit about Buddhist texts, so if this is your first episode, obviously you can also read, check out our previous episodes on this same text. But if you're not familiar or you missed it, you may want to check out actually our last episode on Buddhist texts, which will help maybe to explain a little bit just how the Buddhist textual tradition works and where this text fits in. The kind of, I guess, TLDR on that is that this text, this particular text, the Mulabuddhamagakatika or Root Verses of the Middle Way, is kind of a synthesis or explanation or, in a certain sense, a kind of commentary on the Perfection of Wisdom literature, which is the earliest Mahayana literature, the earliest Mahayana sutras. When the Mahayana was getting formulated, it was sort of concurrent with the first appearance of these texts that were calling themselves, people say, Perfection of Wisdom. I've been sort of playing around. I kind of like Gnosis better than Wisdom, thinking about it more. I don't know. It depends on, what your, do you have any thoughts on that, Aura or Yamnaya? Do you have preference as far as that's concerned?
I like that Gnosis, but I actually hadn't really given it much thought before, but I,
sure.
Instinctually, I like that way of phrasing it.
There is definitely something to be said about that. I'm not sure if, Aura said, I haven't really given it much thought either.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's a translation issue. It's not necessarily, it's just sort of like thinking about what, because wisdom at a certain level is like, okay, well, what is that? And it's not to say that it isn't wisdom. It's just, I don't know. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. But yeah, so that's what this text is. And we have done a lot of investigation, which one of the reasons why, we're reading through this text is because it gives us an opportunity to talk about his various topics. Because basically Nagarjuna is going one by one through all the kind of different foundational topics of Buddhist philosophy and of Buddhism, and somebody's up from his nap, and so then it gives us a chance to kind of go through and talk about all those different things.
So, one thing I've really been please, enjoying yes. about this is that so I read this long ago, and going back through it with all of y'all has been very eye-opening for me, because I never really looked that closely at it before. And, now we're looking very closely chapter by chapter. And one of the coolest things about it is that you can kind of imagine Nagarjuna, the first chapter, the second chapter, you can think of him almost like a runner out of the gates. Like he starts running, but he doesn't really get up to full speed. The runner doesn't get up to full speed until, 40 yards into his run or whatever, his sprint. And towards the end now, we're closer to the end than we are to the beginning now of this book, he's setting up these topics and knocking them down that are like these really key, at the beginning is like, well, what is the thing? And what is the notion of going and stuff? And it all relates to Buddhism, but he's kind of laying groundwork a little bit. He's getting up to speed. And then like this chapter is basically an analysis of karma, which is one of the most central teachings of Buddhism. And the next one's on self versus no self. And, towards the end, the last couple of chapters, he talks about the Four Noble Truths, and he talks about, the next one after 18 is 19 is an analysis of time. So like towards the end, each chapter, he's taking on these huge topics and blasting right through them. So it's sound very nerdy, but it's kind of exhilarating, to see this, see somebody's, he's got such a crystalline mind, and the early chapters are very well and good. And I quite like them, but now you can really see him like in his full, at a full gallop. Am I making sense?
It does. You do. But I mean, the way it seems to me almost like what he's doing is he's moving from like the very abstract to much more concrete and precise examples. So whereas he might start with like a thing or going or time, and in these later chapters, he's talking about very precise things like the self or karma. And so in some ways, it's actually easier to get a hold of it because he's using the same kind of arguments that he kind of perfects in the earlier chapters. But then he's using them against these very precise things. And
maybe he's not like a runner. Maybe he's like a missile, right? Because a missile needs to get going, you know, and everything. And then it hones in on his target and boom, you know. So.
And I think with the karma, it's really interesting because it is, I mean, it does seem like this is something that's very easy to attach to attached to it is like karma. It's like very real. But as during one of the discussion I was having with someone else a while back, one of the criticisms they had of Jainism specifically was that they have a very materialistic view of karma almost. And so this is actually has kind of an interesting connection to that, I think. Going after this karma specifically as being not really... just kind of attacking like this very realistic, like materialistic notion of it that you see there.
Yeah, DK, I cut you off. Were you about to say something deeply profound about this setup?
No.
Good night, everybody.
Yeah, no. So I think that's with that, we could just dive in. I mean, I think you're right, though, that this is a... the people don't often necessarily pay attention to the rhetorical structure of texts like this. There is always an internal logic. It may not be our kind of internal logic. It may not be immediately obvious, but there's always a kind of logic at work, and it's important to keep that in mind.
Well, I have a number of things that I want to say about karma. And for our listeners, before we started recording here, I was commenting to YM and DK that we haven't really directly addressed the subject of karma in our show. It comes up in basically every episode because not only is it a central teaching of Buddhism, but it's, I believe it can be shown that it's a fundamental feature of reality. I mean, that's why the Buddha teaches it, not because like, hey, here's an interesting idea that might be useful. It's like, no, this is actually how the world works. So even people, you know, and this is going to sound very dogmatic of me, but, you know, as a Buddhist, I actually believe that people who aren't Buddhists are also living by the laws of karma. They just don't, you know, they're not thinking about it, not realizing it. And so it's this super important, super key central topic. However, you know, in the verses of chapter, 17 here, Nagarjuna is addressing some very specific ideas about it and also doing his sort of usual trick of breaking apart the Abhidharma sort of standard views of what, how to interpret what the Buddha taught. And he's sort of taking it apart and showing how there's emptiness underlying this concept and that concept. And so it's getting a little bit outside the purview of the book, of the verses themselves, to start talking about karma in general. Nevertheless, I think, you know, now's our opportunity to sort of dive into it. But I guess to my co-hosts here, I'm not sure what to do first, to talk about karma in general first or to address, you know, the actual text first. So I'm open to doing it either way.
I think karma, like addressing karma in general first would probably be helpful just to get an introduction to the text later.
Sure, why not?
Well, I'll say a couple things, and this is, I'm not, you know, I guess I say this too much, but I'm not a scholar of these things, and I'm not an enlightened master either, so I always hesitate to start talking out of school. Nevertheless, I did agree to be, to host and be on a podcast about Buddhism addressing karma, so if I don't have something to say, there's no reason to be here. I do have something to say.
God damn it,
say it. Stop. enough preamble, Aura. So the first thing to understand, this is very basic, is that karma is not, the law of karma is not a law of punishment and reward. I think this is probably most of our listeners already get that, but let's be very explicit about it. There's not some force out there like tallying up how many good boy points you got and rewarding you attendees at the end of the day for, you know, for how many boxes you've checked or something. It's not, and you don't get punished for bad karma in the sense of like, you were a bad boy, you need to learn a lesson, here's some bad experiences to punish you for being a naughty boy, you know, like it, that's not what it is. And it's simply the way things are, right? One way to look at the law of karma is that it's almost like Newton's laws. It's just a fact that you, it sounds kind of cheesy or whatever, but that you get out what you put in. And it's an immutable law of at least the samsaric existence, you know, everyday normal existence. And you can either live in ignorance of this law or start coming up with reasons why it's not true or something, or you can understand it and conform with it and improve your situation as a result. And I know that sounds like maybe I'm dodging the intellectual question or something, like, well, this is just the way it is, so shut up and take it. I'm not going to explain it. But I guess I would just say that, like so much in Buddhism, the question dodging isn't it's like an above and beyond style of question dodging, because instead of saying, well, prove this to me, and then coming up with the proof. And by the way, there are good proofs for this that somebody more erudite than myself could come up with. But the invitation, at least by many masters I've heard, and I think in the teachings of the Buddha himself, is to just sit down and observe it and see whether or not it's true. And it is very, very, very much true. And one of the ways in which karma can be seen in your own life, you don't have to wait for your future lives or anything like that, and you don't need to get total enlightenment into how your past lives were or anything. You can just see it in your day-to-day. But take the example of your state of mind when you're feeling hostile to other people. You're putting out hostile energy towards other people, and maybe resentment, or I don't like this guy for that reason, and you're dwelling on it, and you're suffering as a result, and you're putting out bad energy to other people. And you might treat another person in a bad way because of your feeling of hostility towards that person. And in the future, somebody's going to do something to you that you're going to interpret and feel as hostile. And in other words, you're getting hostile energy back from the world, and it hurts, and it makes you more angry, or it makes you feel rejected, or whatever those feelings are. And that's all negative and a bad stream of karma. But now imagine that you were putting out good energy and love and goodwill towards other people, and then that second person came along and gave you quote unquote hostile energy. It would go right off your back, like water off a duck's back. It would just roll right off of you. You wouldn't even interpret it as hostile. You might have a loving feeling towards that person, not in a sort of, you know, sickly sweet kind of way, but a genuine feeling of like, you know, compassion and happiness and everything. And so that second person's actions could be exactly the same in the first case and the second case. But in the first case, you interpret it as negative and hateful and everything because of your past karma of putting out negativity and hatred. In the second case, because you started with love and goodwill and things like that, you don't actually receive a wound from that second person's quote-unquote hostile feelings. So it sounds like, oh, it's just a trick of the mind or something. And there are other ways in which karma manifests, you know, on the physical plane, you know, with, you know, disease or accidents and things like that. But, you know, 95% of our life is mental. It's how we're interpreting the things that are happening to us. And most of the time, we're not getting hit by a car or stricken with a horrible disease or something. We're just living our day to day. And it's totally up to you. It's up to me every day what kind of karma I want to put out, and I get back what I put out. And it sounds so simplistic that it's almost silly sounding, except for that we tend not to live this way. It's one of those basic truths that's easily observable, and you can actually change the karma that you're creating and therefore the karma that you're receiving, but only if you're humble enough to sit down and say and admit that this is true, and that you are creating these things, and that it's up to you to decide what you want to get back. There's much more to karma than that, but that is sort of the easiest way I can suggest to people to prove it to themselves in their own lives.
The way I like to think about karma and why it makes so much sense to me is, if you look at the way that the world tends to work, when you exert a certain amount of force on an object, that object is going to move in sort of proportion with the amount of force you're exerting upon it. So if we assume among all the systems of moral realism, and I guess maybe it's not exactly precise to say karma is, if we're really autistic about it, maybe it's not precisely moral realism, but of all those systems, why wouldn't it work like this? Why wouldn't it work in the same way we observe the universe actually works? Why should we then try to reduce it to some kind of like judicial system view of morality? Where would that come from? And that's kind of like why I think it makes so much sense.
The key point is that karma, the word, literally just means like action or doing or thing that is done, essentially. So, and it's just an obvious thing that actions, which is to say causes, have effects. When there's an action, when there's a thing that happens, that thing that happens makes other things happen. That's putting it in those terms makes it seem too simple, but what do you want to say? That's just how it is. And so the key point is, when we're talking, so this chapter is an analysis of karma, literally action and fruit. But action is, if you watching the video, but for those who are seeing the stream or seeing a replay on YouTube, and for those of you who are just listening, the editors, the translators introduce this chapter by saying this chapter examines the relation between an action, karman, and its consequence or fruit, phala. The relation specified by what are now commonly called the laws of karma. So when you are thinking, like, mental activity is a kind of activity, right? So when you are using your mind, I mean, even if you want to be kind of reductionist physicalist about it, which is, that's a stupid position, and is, nothing to, if you want to say like the mind is the brain or something, like that's just dumb. But okay, fine, the mind is the brain. It nevertheless remains the case that when you think, when your brain is active, that action leads to certain effects. Now, some of those effects are, immediate and obvious. Others may be less so, but the principle is not in question. The principle that the way that you use your mind, thinking about something or not, whatever it is, the first verse here, which is really kind of getting at the heart of it in a sense, is, Arjuna says, self-control, being thoughtful of others, and friendliness, these states of mind are meritorious and the seeds of fruit both hereafter and here. Meaning that if we behave with self-control, if we are thoughtful and kind, that those are good, wholesome, kushala states of mind, and that they will lead to good results. Yeah, now that, from a certain kind of a perspective, you want to be a sort of extreme skeptic about it, maybe you don't necessarily accept that at face value. And that's fine. I think this is the kind of thing that's open to a certain amount of experimentation, in the sense that, try it and see how it goes. But the point is that what we're investigating here is the fact that it's our intentions. As in the second verse, he says, action was said by the supreme sage, in other words, the Buddha, to be volition. And what is brought about by volition? He has proclaimed there to be many distinct varieties of action. And this is really key, because from a kind of classical Buddhist perspective, we talked a little bit last time in our discussion of Buddhist texts about the Abhidharma. For the Abhidharma kind of school or way of looking at it, action is intention. What we are orienting our minds towards, that is action. That is the heart of it. There, and it's important to understand also from a we'll get into this a little bit maybe later on in the chapter, but you know, Buddhism is always like a little bit ambivalent about what is the relationship between mind and matter. Like, from a, there's always this, on the one hand, a certain kind of common sense perspective. It's like, well, you know, there's mind and there's matter, and you know, that sort of matches our kind of ordinary everyday experience. Like, most people are not extremely autistic Daniel Dennett type, you know, like there's all these brains and chemicals, everything. Like, that's obviously retarded. Most people understand that there are minds in addition to matter, at the least in addition to matter. But
you're right that it's much more ambivalent in Buddhism and in Indic religions in general, and I would say also East Asian religions in general. It's almost a particularity of the West, of the European tradition, to even have this worry about the mind body. You know, the Cartesian dualism and stuff is sort of a heritage that really only one
it's really
major
only
world philosophical
and not even
tradition has
the,
a problem with.
And not even in every European tradition. It's really just this one kind of strand of it. It's been dominant for a few hundred years.
Yeah, that's the thing, is all of us on this stream and listening to it and everything, I grew up saturated in the mind-body dualism. Whether you're a hardcore Christian or you're a fedora-tier atheist or whatever you are, it's so hard to completely divorce your mind from the idea that the body is one thing and the mind is something else. But that there's no reason that should be a given. You know, I mean, maybe there are some reasons according to Descartes or something, but I mean, we don't have to accept.
We don't accept that. Yeah, right. And certainly as Buddhists, we don't accept that. But the point I wanted to make just was that when we're talking about this thing about like you mental activity leads to a certain result, and activity as such is mental. It is volitional. Like, it's the volition that constitutes activity kind of in general. That implies a certain kind of idealistic framework, meaning that, like, in a sense, everything is mind, that is most explicit in especially the Yogacara school of Mahayana philosophy. But, like, we'll see here, you know, Nagarjuna talks in a certain way that's kind of, I mean, it's not exclusive to Yogacara. He's building on, you know, Yogacara itself is building on Abhidharma and all these previous, you know, it came about. It started about 1,000 years after the Buddha. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that goes into it, but the point is that, you know, it's a kind of common thing in a lot of these Mahayana sutras and in general to say, for the Buddha to say, you know, well, everything that, at least all phenomena are mind. Now, everything that appears is mind. Now, what does that mean? Whether that means that there actually isn't anything other than like mental stuff, that, you know, that's maybe potentially theoretically a separate question. But it's important to understand that, like, so much of Buddhism, especially, well, no, I wouldn't even say especially Mahayana, Theravada, all the way back, every level, Buddhism is fundamentally concerned with the mind more than any other single thing, and in particular with being aware of what it is that our minds are doing at any particular moment, and seeing what is the relationship between what our minds are doing or have done and what it is that we are experiencing or how it is that we are experiencing it. That's really the key point. And that's, in a sense, what this is about, because this chapter, I mean, because the sort of framework here is so in the third, he lays out in the first five verses here, it's kind of the standard model, so to speak, of karma. He says, of these, that which is called volition is known as mental action, and that which is called what is brought about by volition is bodily and verbal action. So notice, like, the volition is the mental action, and then you can move your body, or you can say something, you know, and writing, so to speak, would be considered a kind of speech in a way in this tradition. But the point is that, you know, we have bodily movements, and we have kind of intentional speech acts, but these all go back to what our mind intends. The root of all of this is what is our volition? What is our intention? In what way are our minds oriented? And that's really the heart of it. And so then he goes through speech, gesture, what is known as the unmanifest, unrestrained, blah, blah, blah. But the point is that all of this comes back to our minds. or I feel like I just wanted to finish that point. I feel like I cut you off.
No, you didn't cut me off at all. In fact, just to piggyback on what you said, we've mentioned it before on the show that also when we say mind in the Buddhist context, it might properly be translated as heart mind or mind heart, because these are considered sort of, the citta is both of these things together. So it's another sort of cultural idea that Westerners have, this split. There's your mind, and we sort of think of that as sort of your rational, analytical interiority, and then your emotions or your heart is something that's it's your emotions, it's your felt experience, your interiority that's pre-rational or super-rational or sub-rational, depending on how you want to look at it. And the term mind, when we're talking about it here, really encompasses all of the above. So that's why, when we think about intentionality, when we talk about intentionality or volition behind one's actions, whether they're bodily or they're verbal or whatever, it can kind of sound like you're saying, oh, I have to be one of those self-improvement people that's like writing down their goals every morning and then reviewing them at night. Not that there's anything wrong with that can be a very good practice, but it doesn't, your volition does not have to be this kind of like, I shall now be a dick and then proceed to being a dick, or I shall now be a nice guy and proceed to be a nice guy. It happens on a very, very subtle level. And in fact, part of the teaching of the Buddha and the one of the central reasons behind the meditation in general is to be able to look at your mind and to see that, on some level you are actually saying, I shall now be a dick, and then you proceed to be a dick or whatever. Although usually in lived day-to-day experience, it happens so quick and it's so subtle and it seems so, it seems to sort of happen before you choose it to happen. The teaching of the Buddha is that we are all of us capable of making those choices deliberately. But it doesn't mean that you're just like, oh, I'm going to get super rational about it. I'm going to get super analytical. Yes, you use your rational side and your analytical side to help you in this process. But it's not like the brain has to take over from the heart. They work together. And in some senses, in the Buddhist context, they're the same thing.
I would almost think it would be correct to say not only does it exist in conjunction with the heart, but also in conjunction with whatever is being conceived of or whatever is being perceived or some other object of consciousness. So when we think of it like that, I mean, a lot of that volition would come as a result of desiring a particular thing or grasping.
Could you rephrase that? The first part of what you said, I didn't quite catch it.
Basically, the mind is seen as only existing in relation with, it exists together with the heart, so the mind-heart. But, I mean, it also would be correct to say that the mind exists in conjunction or independence of, like, some object that is perceiving, like the... So, and that's, I mean, it would be correct to say that as well, wouldn't it?
I think so. I mean, it sounds like a very Mahayana idea it sounds also correct to me, by the way, even though I self-identify as a Mahayana, but I mean, I don't know. Yes. I mean, there's, I don't even want to try to rephrase it, but I think I know what you're saying and I think I agree.
Yeah. And so a lot of the volition then, I mean, when we talk about the volition, it sometimes is going to be maybe a little bit, it won't be like the desire to be their direct desire of, I just want to be a dick, for instance, is not going to be there. But because there's like a grasping towards a particular thing, like I want this, and so therefore I'm willing to be a dick in order to get it.
Right.
That would exist together with it.
Right. And I've said this before as well, but it's one of the most life altering revelations I've ever had in my life, in any context, Buddhist or not Buddhist, is really just happened in the last couple of years for me. And I'm still learning to sort of internalize it, but it's the realization that even my bad emotions are done because some part of me thinks that it's going to make me happy to feel that way, that it's, it is clinging. It is desire. It's desire. Now, and I think Storm was on the call when I said it, and we were talking about anger. Maybe it was that episode. I can't remember actually, but I was saying, you know, some part of you likes feeling angry, and he's like, oh yeah, it feels so good. And I think that's a common one. People can acknowledge that, like, yeah, they like getting fired up and angry over stuff. And so that's kind of an easy hurdle to clear. But I went on to say, and I'll repeat it now, even the worst kinds of emotions that are way less fun than anger, like depression or self-loathing or, you know, this really awful feeling, you know, dread of the future, you know, just blackpilling in general, all these kinds of feelings, those are also chosen. And it, you know, it can be really unhelpful to tell people that sometimes when they're in the middle of those emotions that, by the way, you're choosing to feel this shitty, you know, like people who are really despairing, who hate themselves, or who feel really lost and really alone, or whatever. Loneliness is another one. Loneliness is such an awful feeling when you really are in the throes of it and you feel rejected by the world, you feel unloved and alone, even in the, you know, you might even be in the presence of your own quote-unquote loved ones and you feel so alone. It's an awful feeling, and we've all felt it, you know, in our lives at some point or another. And some people, you know, right now are in the middle of it and can't get out from it. And if you say to that person, well, you're choosing to feel that way, that can be very unhelpful, right? Because it doesn't feel like a choice. So, you know, in Buddhism, there's the idea of, you know, skillful means, skillful teaching, upaya, right? So maybe the Buddha himself would not come out and say, you know, you're actually choosing to feel that way. however, it is really... Go ahead.
I mean, the thing is, I agree with you that there is that choice to feel lonely on a certain level. But the question is, my view is the choice is almost more implicit. Like someone, instead of doing something difficult, like going out and talking to actual people, they would just rather, you know, sit around and play video games and jerk off to porn all day. And so then why am I lonely? Well, you're choosing to be lonely because you're choosing to do that instead of this more difficult thing.
Yes, there is that, absolutely. And that's another, you know, manifestation of karma, of course, by the way, is that if you choose certain actions, you're going to get certain results. But I'm talking about on an even more subtle level what the revelation that was so helpful for me and that has been so life transformative for myself personally is not focusing on like, oh, my negative emotions, I'm choosing them. It's the really happy, sunny, beautiful flip side of that exact same coin, which is I can choose other feelings and I can cultivate other feel. I don't have to feel that way. And it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of sitting. It takes a lot of looking, you know, sitting with your eyes closed, alone in quiet and in, you know, the darkness or in low light or whatever. And it's fucking sucks sometimes. It's dark, right? But on the other side of that sort of dark night of the soul is this choice that you're like, wow, when I have those feelings, it's just this kind of, it's like a tape recorder that's playing again and again and again. And you're like, actually, I can hit stop. And this is, you know, I'm talking in sort of like self-helpy kind of terms and it sounds kind of cheesy or whatever. But sincerely for our listeners, this is actually what the Buddha like explicitly was teaching. He's like, you don't have to, you know, these things that you're, it's clinging. It's you're clinging to these. You have a sense of self that I am a depressed, a lonely person or whatever these feel, an angry person or whatever these things are, a lustful person. And if I stop feeling anger or lust or loneliness or something, then I am no longer there. But that is a delusion. That's not true at all. You can let those things go and you, like I was saying on a previous episode, you become more yourself, not less yourself. Now, of course, you start talking about becoming yourself and everything. This is very problematic because Buddha, Buddhism has the doctrine of no self. But on a sort of operational day-to-day mundane level, before reaching total enlightenment, on the path to reaching total enlightenment, you can find this space between yourself and your own emotions and deliberately start choosing better ones. And there's nothing there's nothing inauthentic about it. And in fact, it's the root of real authenticity. But I have to cut myself off because I could really keep rambling like this. Like
no, it's not rambling, and it's a great it's a great topic. Maybe we can come back at some point. I mean, I'm sure there's going to be another opportunity.
We should get back to the text, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's not unrelated. Obviously, this is all the question, the kind of animating question in the text is, how do we account for the fact that the results of our actions are not always immediately evident? Now, in a kind of classical Buddhist example, this is the kind of thing where, like, if to put a kind of negative spin on it, I always, these days, when I see something like this airplane that was shot down in Iran, right? Like 100 people, oftentimes like whole families, just like poof, gone in an instant, right? Terrible tragedy. Okay. Without, again, very importantly, like Aura very correctly noted, without moralizing about it, without seeing it as some kind of like, you know, this is just a kind of neutral principle of cause and effect. You know, it's not hard for me, at least, to imagine, at some point in the Yamnaya years, 20,000 or whatever years ago, one of these people just fucking murdered a whole family. In fact, each one of them just fucking murdered a whole family, right? And maybe they didn't experience that until 20,000 years later. You know, they and their family are now, boom, gone in an instant. That's maybe sounds unfair. I remember when I was like first encountering this stuff, I was like, that's not fair. I'm like, okay, well, in a certain sense, it's the most fair thing it is. But yeah, I mean, the point is it's not, again, no part of this, I mean, we've said this before, we're going to say it again. No part of this is about victim blaming. It's just.
Well, I think
yes, and actually, please. I think that's. Go ahead.
No, both of you. Please.
Let me just say. Let me. I think the objection people have is not so much that it's not fair or whatever, because you can explain how it is fair. It's that I think the objection is like, well, that's awfully convenient of you to have that explanation.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I guess at a certain level it is, but like the point is, first of all, only fully enlightened Buddhas know all of the reasons why things happen. Like you have to have that level, in order to have that kind of level of fine-grained knowledge, you have to have completely perfect gnosis or whatever. Go on.
You know, actually, I mean, I would say that it isn't completely wrong to say that there is sort of a kind of element of unfairness there. And I think that that is one thing that a lot, I mean, one of the objections I hear to people talking about karma is that it can encourage people to be callous, because it's almost like people are getting exactly what they deserve. And, you know, I mean, when you think of it like that, it actually should be a cause for compassion. It's more than anything else. You should be, when you see people in a bad situation, you should actually feel compassion for them, because there is possibly that certain element of, well, that doesn't seem fair to it. That's just kind of my thought on it.
Yes, I agree. I think maybe DK had to step away just for a second.
Oh, sorry. I thought I was muted. I didn't realize that I was...
No. Yeah, you must be muted.
No, what I was saying is there are also things you can do. Vajrasattva meditation in the Tibetan tradition in particular is basically geared towards purifying your past negative actions. And, you know, it's not like... It's actually a confession practice, very similar to confession in the Christian tradition. And the idea is like you feel sincere remorse, and it's that sincere remorse that kind of powers the thing. But through the power of sincere remorse and a sincere conviction to not do the same thing again, you can actually reduce or even eliminate the consequences of prior negative actions, at least to some extent. So yeah, I mean, it's not hopeless by any stretch. It's just important to understand that, you know, what we experience is the result of our own prior actions, including most particularly our own prior mental actions, our own prior volition. And this also means to kind of like keep on, you know, piling on the sidetracks, but whatever, is that what we need to be most concerned with is not so much necessarily changing our, you can force your bodily behavior to change. You can force, you know, there's all kind of, you know, sheer power of will, and that can be even good. I'm not saying that you shouldn't do that, but the key point isn't so much forcing ourselves to behave a certain way or forcing things in a certain direction or you know, be it, it, the key point is to work on our intentions, to sort of work on purifying our intentions so that what it is that we want, what it is that we're oriented towards, is wholesome and good and leads to a long-term benefit for ourselves and others. That's really the key point, more than anything else. And that's all I have.
I am nodding vigorously as you speak. That is so true, so exactly true, and it is something I think that gets forgotten a lot. I will say from my own perspective, I often forget that is really, that's what we're doing, and you know, you got to remind yourself again and again with this, because the thing is, it really works. It's, I sometimes view it as a lesson in time preference, in extending your ability to have what is it, long time preference, right? Again, I'll just speak for myself. I like my personality is, I'm loquacious and I'm a fast reader and I pick things up quickly. So in that sense, you might say that like I have a good functional intelligence. You know, I'm a smart person. Uh-huh. But I have bad low time preference sometimes, and sometimes I'm like, well, it doesn't matter what I do because, you know, whatever, you know, who knows. But the teaching of karma and the lesson you can actually learn on the meditation cushion is that it really does matter. And again, the key for me was not thinking about, oh, if I do something bad, it's going to lead to bad consequences, although that is true. It was more just that if I do something good, whether that's, you know, an act of generosity or morality or just, you know, sitting down and meditating or you know, cleaning my room, bucko, right? Well, anything like that. It does act, you do actually reap the consequences of that. Like you do actually improve your situation that way. And I think for some people that's kind of obvious and they might look down on other people who don't get that intuitively. But I know there are many, many people out there that are smart people who still sometimes think like, ah, what's the use? I'm just going to do whatever, you know, I'm going to be a dick or I'm going to do these drugs or whatever I'm going to go jerk off to porn or, you know, whatever it is that you're, you know, this temporary indulgence that's going to lead to bad actions.
To kind of continue that thread, the key point even there, this is like kind of hard advice, hard learned that I'm not great at following, but for what it's worth, you know, I'm just an internet racist, whatever. The key point is actually not to blame yourself when you fall short, when we all have bad habits and when you indulge in them. Understand that you engage in your bad habit, whatever it is, because you are habituated, because it is a habit, right? And so the number one thing, like before anything else, is to be just pay attention to how you feel when you are engaged. Like don't even necessarily, especially at first, really don't try to stop yourself. Pay attention instead to how it feels. Pay attention to the subjective quality of your experience. Pay attention to how it makes you feel. Pay attention to the desire that you feel. Pay attention to where it seems to be coming from. Pay attention to the whole process. Just be aware of the whole process. That, more than anything else, is how you're going to start actually like getting your kind of rational mind's ability to identify the bad habit as a bad habit more like on a better connected to your kind of the brute raw fact that you are unable to prevent yourself from indulging. That's these things need to be equalized, and the way to do that is to pay attention, which is also related to a question. We had a great question from Joe Schmo 123. So there is no karma created in actions performed without a concern for the fruits of the action. This is like, I don't want to get too far afield. We're already kind of way far afield, which is fine. But in a sense, like from a certain so the way that this is often presented, this material is often presented, is that is in terms of what's called the three spheres of agent, action, and object. And so, in other words, like when to be kind of, I guess, blunt about it, like without any sort of moral, you want to hit a ball, right? You're playing baseball, you want to hit the ball. And this actually does come up later in the chapter if we do end up getting there. But so in that kind of a model, it's like, okay, I am playing baseball, I want to hit the ball. So I am me, I am the agent, I am the one doing the hitting of the ball. The ball is the thing that I am hitting, and the hitting of it is the actual activity. And when you're doing that, like, it can be very subtle, but there's tends to be a sense of, like, you feel like you are the one doing the action, and the action is actually happening. And this also relates very closely to, if you go to an earlier episode in the chapter on going in particular, that's sort of that's what that is about. So the key point is, if you have this kind of sense, and it's not something you can just sort of like just convince yourself to drop. It's one of the most deeply ingrained things about our experience. It's not something that, you know, you can come to a certain rational understanding, and that's good. That's in fact necessary, but it's not enough. You have to like practice sort of, that's what meditation practice at a certain level is all about, is like really getting hands-on experience with, like, there is no, like, it's not that I am here meditating and meditating is a thing that is happening. That no longer applies. Anyway, so when you are genuinely acting, and this would be in the tradition kind of associated or identified with the realization of emptiness. Like when you have a genuine hands-on experiential understanding of emptiness, what that means, the kind of cash value of that, is that you are no longer acting in that way. That, like, and in a sense, yeah, it means you're performed without a concern for the fruits of the action. Like, yes, that's a feature of it. But that, you know, I don't want to say wholeheartedly just that it's simple enough to say that, like, oh, if you just act without caring how it's going to end up, that doesn't create karma. No, because someone very stupid and short-sighted and ignorant can also just sort of, I mean, like, that could just be extremely low time preference, right? Like, oh, I'll just fucking do this, whatever.
Yeah, that's like a really lazy person's way out, because like it's sort of technically true, but it's like, nah, that it doesn't work like that.
Yeah, exactly. So for that reason, I don't want to say, but it is true that, like, if in the sense of not having this kind of, in a way you could call it phenomenological sense of, like, I am here doing thing, that's like, it's non-conceptual and it's pre-theoretical. It's not something you're actively thinking about. It's a built-in feature of your experience. Our experience, that's how experience normally is. But if you can, through meditation, acclimatize yourself to no longer having that sense, or at least not as much of a sense, then yeah, you can act in a way. In fact, that is like, activity done without that is, you could say, and that's how it gets talked about in the tradition rhetorically, that is Buddha activity, essentially. That is like what it means to act, to have enlightened activity, is an activity that is done out of a spontaneous and deep, like it's your intention at that level is completely perfect, which means it's intended to maximally benefit all sentient beings without exception. It's the most efficient way to lead the beings to enlightenment, and it's happening spontaneously, it's happening without any thought, and it's happening without any like sense of like, I am doing this to benefit beings. It's just sort of, that's how it is, and it's happening every moment, moment by moment. But obviously that's extremely, not just difficult, but like, it takes a lot of training to get there. Right, which is why until we have a certain amount of experience with these kind of things, that we need to work on perfecting our intentions in more conceptual ways, in more like, you know, we need to work on refining and purifying our intentions in the way that, you know, I am aware that you know, I want to be kind, I want to be generous, and that is working on my intention. And by working on my intention that way, then eventually my intention becomes pure in a way that I don't have to force myself to sort of understand, like, oh, I should be generous, I should be patient, etc. It's like, then because you start becoming more habituated to behaving in a way that is kind and generous and so on, then that can manifest spontaneously. But it takes time. It takes time. It takes effort. It's not something that you can just sort of reason yourself into. This was a mistake that I made. I just, like, cards, whatever. Again, I'm just fucking, don't listen to me, whatever. But just, I'm saying, like, when I sort of, it's easy when you when you're encountering this stuff to be like, oh, I'm just going to do this. It doesn't work that way. You can't, like, reason yourself into it. It's important to reason. It's important to use your reason to understand these things. But just having reached the conclusion by reason, that's like, that's the beginning, not the end.
One of the things that Thai Forest Ajahns talk about a lot is in breath meditation. It's like training for greater things. You're able to break things down on a very basic level and take them in little bite-sized chunks and learn that way, because the law of karma is in operation at all times and in all places and with all kinds of actions. And so these big things, you know, like the Iranian airplane getting shut down and those kinds of grand sweeping results of karma are kind of baffling sometimes. But in breath meditation, for example, and this is in many traditions, but I'll just speak about in the Thai Forest tradition, the idea is to sit down and just very simply start trying to make your breath feel good, like have it feel pleasant to be breathing in and breathing out. And that's very straightforward and simple. But of course, anybody who sits down and tries to do it realizes it's not very easy, especially at first. But it is, you know, it's simple. You know, there's no one yelling at you. You don't have to, like, you know, you're not playing Frogger, trying to jump across the street or anything. You're just sitting there and breathing, and you're just trying to do that. And in that, you get to see how your intentions, your volition, your mind state can actually manifest certain qualitative states. And you sit there and just practice with the breath over and over and over again. And there's many, many things going on during that, but two very important things that are going on. One, on a very sort of simple and mundane level, you're just making it feel good, so it's nice to sit and meditate. You're just sort of, the Thai Forest guys talk about this a lot, like, make it feel good so that you want to do it. Because if it sucks, if your breath is painful or tight or annoying or whatever, your mind is not going to want to sit there. It's going to want to go fleeting off to somewhere else and think about either things that you want or things that you hate or whatever. But very importantly, the other thing that's going on is, in addition to making it feel nice, you're also getting a chance to see karma in action. Your present choices will have an influence on your felt experience. And by making a series of deliberate choices again and again and again, moment by moment during the breath meditation, you actually will manifest a certain kind of feeling within your own body, within your own, you know, breath energy, if you will. And if you, at the end of the meditation, you can look back and see, had I not done that, I would not feel this way right now. I literally just created that feeling, this state of being. My life has actually changed in this last half hour or hour or 20 minutes, however long you meditated, as a result of my intentions. And that's so simple, but it's, if you can think about it in those terms, it's a big eye opener, because you realize, wow, it really is true. Moment by moment, whatever intentions I put into the moment are going to manifest. Now, in breath meditation, they tend to manifest a little bit quicker than in the grand sweeping scheme of life, with all your, you know, the vicissitudes of outside life and everything. But it's a real lesson. And it's one of the key lessons of the meditation, is to see how you're creating your own karma every moment of every day.
So I think we need to, like, try.
Actually, oh, please. I was kind of thinking of that. Does that, I mean, I'm kind of thinking, like, in terms of, there's a pair, as far as, like, the intention and the effect of karma, I don't know if this is specific. I know in some Theravada traditions, there's this meditation called metta, which is almost like the idea of sending loving kindness or good intentions out to to others. And it sounds very similar, I guess, to us. There's a practice in the Tibetan tradition called Tonglen.
Which, yeah, it's very similar to Tonglen, I would say. Yeah.
Yes.
Keep going, though. Sorry.
No, I mean that seems like a very powerful example of that same kind of idea of good intentions having this kind of manifestation of positive effects on your own life and your own mind and your own state. And so that's just something that came to mind for.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. But I also sense that DK wanted to pull us back towards the text. Am I correct,
yes.
DK?
Let's do it. I mean, just because I can't stay too much longer. But it doesn't, you know, in a sense, it almost doesn't even really, like, I mean, I could summarize the, first of all, this I want to point out, this is very a traditional way of, like, if you ever sit down in a proper, like, monastic university setting, the teacher will just kind of go on about their own thing for a long time and then maybe get to the text in the last 10% of whatever thing. So that's kind of traditional in a way. So whatever, slash trad, slash. But, yeah, the kind of TLDR on it, I guess, is just the in verse 6, Nagarjuna says, you know, if the action endures the time of maturation, then it would be permanent. If it is destroyed, then being destroyed, what fruit, what result will it produce? In other words, how are we going to conceptualize, like, if I have, let's say, a hateful thought, this is why, to kind of do a side note thing, but again, it's all related. You know, I've said on the third rail and elsewhere, you know, we had a whole episode on forgiveness, and I think it's really important. And I got some pushback in the, you know, dissident right sphere. Not a whole lot, but some from people who were saying, like, you know, oh, I'll forgive our enemies when they, like, stop hurting us. I'm like, I'm not saying the point is not to we're not forgiving them for them. We're forgiving them for us. And because having a hateful moment of mind, having a hateful, harmful intent, an intent to harm, to cause suffering, that is something that we are going to experience negatively. That is something that we're going to experience as a negative result, as our own suffering, essentially. And so the key point is, though, that we aren't necessarily aware of, like, you know, the relationship between the moment where we have a hateful intention and the moment at some point in the future where we experience the result of that as our own suffering. And so the key question is, what is that action, that mental action, that intention to cause harm, is that permanent or not, right? And both of these come with problems, because if it's permanent, then it's always there, and maybe it can, you know, it would never be destroyed, and maybe even never come to fruition. But if it is destroyed, if it's only impermanent, strictly impermanent in the sense that it's just, you know, gone, then you would never experience the results of our actions. And from a Buddhist perspective, that's not acceptable, and also just kind of in general, that's clearly not how things work. So the kind of TLDR on the argument in this chapter, which, I mean, I don't know that it's necessary to really go through verse by verse, is just that Nagarjuna shows how really both of these accounts don't really work. And essentially, if you want to have an account where we're gonna say that there are things like actions and effects and results and so on, then much like we were in our prior discussions of the seed and the sprout, I mean, that's exactly the metaphor that he uses. Then in the same way that there is no real seed, and each moment of the continuum is empty, like, it's not that we're saying, like, there's really a function at the time and then a derivative of that function. It's not like we're doing an infinitesimal analysis, like a mathematical sense, where, you know, each individual infinitesimal moment is real. That's not the case, because each individual infinitesimal moment is subject to the same kind of critique as everything else. So, you know, where did it come from? Where did it go? Blah, blah, blah. You know, where Cotton Eye Joe. So, like, none of that works. But it nevertheless remains the case that, from a certain kind of sense, we're not denigrating that, quote unquote, in the past, with all the problems that you don't want to reify the past, there was a seed. And, quote unquote, later in the future, and certainly without reifying that, in a sense, linguistically, we can talk about there is a sprout that emerges in relationship upon that seed in a certain kind of continuum. And that continuum is unbroken. And in exactly that same kind of a way, the continuum of action is unbroken. There is a continuum of mental events that continues and persists. And it's the sense in which these seed, like metaphorically you could say, eventually ripens as a certain kind of experience. If we have a good intention, it ripens as a good experience. If we have a bad, harmful intention, it ripens as a bad experience. So, to kind of close it in verse 26, he says, "You hold that action is by nature defiled and the defilements are not ultimately real. If for you, Nagarjuna, the defilements are not real, how would action be ultimately real? Action and the defilements are described as conditions for the arising of the body. If action and the defilements are empty, then what is to be said of the body?" And basically Nagarjuna replies, he says, "Since the action does not exist dependent on conditions and does not exist having sprung up without dependence upon conditions, therefore the agent also does not exist. If there is neither agent nor action, how would there be the fruit born of the action? Moreover, if the fruit does not exist, how will there be its enjoyer? Just as the teacher, the Buddha, by his supernatural power, fabricates a magical being that in turn fabricates yet another magical being, so with regard to the agent, which has the form of a magical being, and the action that is done by it, it is like the case where a second magical being is fabricated by a magical being. Defilements, actions, and bodies, agents, and results are similar to the city of the Gandharvas. They are like a mirage, a dream." The city of the Gandharvas, this is like a sort of a... these are magical creatures that are only perceptible to yogis with special abilities. The point is that, you know, all of this is... none of this is real the way that we think of it as being real. It's all like illusions that are produced by illusions that are produced by illusions that are produced by illusions and so on. Like, none of this... we have this... the most fundamental, deeply ingrained tendency is that we tend to think of things around us, are the objects of our everyday experience, as being real. And in a sense, what Nagarjuna is trying to say is that's really the heart of our problem. It's that kind of pre-theoretical, Yamnaya used the word earlier, clinging. This is a kind of almost a technical term in Tibetan Buddhist circles, but it's true. That's sort of the word that gets used, and that's sort of what it means. It doesn't necessarily mean... it can mean clinging in the sense of, you know, how we are really attached to stuff in a kind of effective way. But really, the more important sense is more subtle. And the more important sense is this very subtle clinging of, like, I'm looking at a pen and I don't remember that it's empty of the essence of a pen, and that, you know, it's actually what, you know, from a certain kind of, like, if not even the ultimate perspective, just a certain kind of more intelligent perspective, it's made out of atoms. It's not like a gross object. It's made out of particles, but I don't even see the particles. No part of my experience is the particles. Instead, I'm like treating it as though it's this kind of gross mid-sized object. And I totally lose track of the fact that, like, you know, the atoms are producing, the atoms are producing a certain kind of mental representation or cognitive image in my mind. And that's what I'm interacting with. That's what I see. Like, what I'm seeing is my mind, in a sense, in the shape or the form of the pen. But I don't, like, think of it that way. I think of it as a real pen that exists outside my mind and is solid and stable. And, you know, if I look away, then it's going to continue to be there. And of course, I'm not saying everything is, quote unquote, everything is subjective. it's not the point. The point is that we're used to thinking of things as having a certain kind of reality, and that's the root of the problem. And all this stuff about causes and effects, like if you want to have an account of conventional reality where there are causes and effects, then we have to pay attention to the ways in which the stream of action and effect is unbroken, and the stream of our mental intentions, you know, like we carry within us at each moment the seeds of our prior intentions. That's what shapes us. That's what shapes our experience. That doesn't go away, but it's empty. And precisely like we've discussed again with causality, I mean, it's all related. Because it's empty, it's only because if it weren't empty, then it couldn't change. If it weren't empty, then you couldn't experience, the result would never come about, because the action would be inherently the action. It would have the inherent nature of being what it was. It would never be able to change. It would never be able to lead to change into a result from an action. But it is able to change into a result because it is empty, and that's why we experience, but it's important not to reify that. Sorry, that was long. I just wanted to get that
dude,
out.
Dude, no, sort of... the, your last 45 seconds or so there is like, shit, man, that's like, that, when people study Nagarjuna, that should be the 45-second rant that they have to listen to, because that is...
I hope so. That is, thank you.
No, I'm not trying to blow smoke up your ass. Like, that is exactly it. That's super clear, and it's actually, for me, really helpful.
I'm glad.
I'll add that idea, like the pen and everything, and we've talked about this a lot, especially on the Nagarjuna episodes, the chariot and the desk and everything. We've talked about all these things, the table, whatever. That is for people who are interested in like Buddhist philosophy and sort of the nitty gritty of the Buddhist way of understanding the world. There's the idea of the five skandhas, and we don't have time to get into them all right now. We have to wrap things up, but.
It was one of the episodes in this series, I believe.
Yeah, it was, but I don't think we ever really.
We didn't go so into so deep. That's true. We didn't go so deep.
And I'm not going to try to explain all five right now because it's hard. But I would just suggest to people that if you feel like you have a pretty good grasp on the Four Noble Truths and some of the other teachings of Buddhism that are, I don't know if I want to call them straightforward, but they're these core teachings. The five skandhas are really worth looking into, and it's kind of hard to grasp at first because the terms that they get translated into, and frankly, I don't even know. I'm not a Pali or Sanskrit guy, but I'm guessing that they're probably a little bit obscure even in the original languages. I mean, these are philosophical ideas essentially, but the more I've learned about them and the more I've tried to interpret these ideas into my own practice and everything, the more they make sense. And anyway, the idea of thinking of a pen as a thing that exists, even though I know on some level that it's all atoms and particles and everything, that's the skandha of perception. And that is like the one of the five basic things that make up our delusion of self, like this faculty of the mind for creating what's called perceptions is one of the five main ways in which our deluded idea of like the permanent self is created out of. Now there are four others, and they're also extremely important, but like I said, we don't have time to get into all of them, but that's just a little sort of window into this philosophy, I guess.
Well, the first verse of the next chapter, which we'll cover next time, or at least in the next episode in this series, says, if the self were the skandhas, it would participate in coming to be and passing away. If it were something other than the skandhas, it would be something having the defining characteristic of a non-skandha. So we can maybe dig into that next time. But yeah, I mean, it's obviously highly relevant, and that's a great segue into our next episode.
Yeah, awesome. So I guess we can wrap up.
Do we have any concluding thoughts?
Yeah, I was going to say, YM, you haven't spoken, so I don't know if we talked over you or anything.
No, I think that what DK said at the end was pretty much like a great summary for this whole chapter. And like you were saying, if you're going to listen to a 45-second introduction, that should probably be it.
I'm flattered, sincerely.
Home run, dude.
Yeah, okay, seriously. Cool. All right, well, I gotta go back to Akanishta. So in the meantime, I hope everyone is having a great time, and we will catch you in the next episode. Where did you come from? Where did you go? Where did you come from, Katna Joe?